This episode sponsored by Maximus Tribe. You train, you track, you eat right. But if you're over 40, you've felt it. The results don't match the effort anymore. That's not willpower, it's biology. Hormones drop, metabolism slows, your body stops responding the way it used to. Maximus is the online clinic that reverses your decline with prescription performance medicines, GLP-1s, testosterone, and peptides that reduce belly fat, restore energy, and boost recovery. Over 50,000 high performers have already broken through their plateaus. If you're ready to turn your hard work into measurable results, go to MaximusTribe.com. That's MaximusTribe.com.
This episode sponsored by We Feed Raw. Have you ever actually looked at the label on your dog's food? Most dog food labels are a long list of things that don't look like food. Powders, starches, additives used to hold ultra-processed kibble together. At We Feed Raw, the label looks very different. High-quality meat, nutrient-rich organs, complete and balanced nutrition formulated by PhD nutrition experts. No fillers, no artificial preservatives, just real ingredients that support your dog's whole body health. That's why many pet parents see real changes after switching to We Feed Raw's fresh meals. If you want to feed your dog one of the healthiest diets possible, We Feed Raw makes it simple. Right now, new customers can get 40% off their starter box plus free shipping. Visit We Feed Raw at wefeedraw.com to get started today.
Deep in the heart of Appalachia, guys set out on a quest to create the greatest podcast.
Sorry, dude. I thought we agreed on the correct pronunciation of Appalachia.
No, dude. We've talked about this. We've talked about this over and over and over. It's pronounced Appalachia.
Listen, freaking angels and the women got together. That's how we got Bigfoot. That's how we got vampires. That's why we got all of this stuff.
These ancient Appalachian mountains that are literally older than bones. There's old entities here. When you start finding out more about them, they start finding out more about you.
Good Lord, sir. This goose has gone rabid. And you think you're just going to run up with your little sword on the king of the goose squad?
Listen, the old entities of Middle Appalachia are unexplainable. They are eerie.
Breach.
And they are one of these things that will keep us, the hill folks, and the people who live in the area, constantly searching for answers that they probably will never, ever find. And this is why we love Appalachian Intelligence.
Hello, folks, and welcome back to Appalachian Intelligence. We hope you guys enjoyed the last episode. We had a great conversation with a great friend of the show, Lance Compton. He had a lot of great ideas, a lot of theories that he was putting out there, and I hope that you guys had as much fun listening to the conversation as we had having it. But today, you know, we keep pumping these guests at you guys, and they keep getting better and better and better. Today, this man has a BA in religion at Duke University, a Master's of Divinity from Yale, did his doctoral work at Princeton. He's a biblical scholar and theologian, author of the book From Egypt to Ohio, and he's an expert in North American giants and the mound builders. Adam Stokes, everybody. Adam, how are you, buddy?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. We're glad to have you. You know, when Ryan actually heard an episode that you did with a good friend of ours, Bo Kennedy from the Bump podcast, and me and Ryan worked together, and we were sitting at lunch that day, and he said, I just listened to a great episode on the Trail of Giants on the Bump podcast. He said, and this guest on there was Adam Stokes. He said, and he was blowing my mind. He said, so we need to try to get him on there or on our show. I said, well, great. I mean, I'll search him up right now. So within 10 minutes, I had requested to follow you on Instagram, had messaged you, and, you know, graciously you messaged back and agreed to come on. So for that, you know, we are super thankful and appreciative to have you on here. But Adam, for the listeners, the audience out there, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yes. Yeah, so, where do I begin? So like you said, I have a background in religious studies, always been kind of fascinated with the ancient world, which is what got me into religious studies. From high school, I was interested in ancient empires, ancient civilizations. I really got into this around seventh grade, I would say, if I had to pinpoint a specific time for it. I started taking a course in Latin, and I went in kicking and screaming because my parents forced me to take it. And I had heard things about Latin being a dead language, but the class I took really kind of opened up a whole nother world for me with these ancient civilizations, Rome and Greece. And from then on, I was hooked. So studied a little bit of quite a bit about ancient Israel during my time in academia. I was on my way to work on a PhD that kind of fell through, but I still always had an interest in the ancient world. And what really got me fascinated about North America is that we don't really talk about any major civilizations here in North America prior to Christopher Columbus. It's kind of just, you know, this was just basically a dead waste with, you know, some Native Americans running around and not realizing that the Native Americans themselves descended from this amazing civilization that once existed here in North America with cities and with technology just as elaborate as you'd find elsewhere in the world, whether Greece, Rome, or even South America. Now, people always talk about South America because you have the pyramids there that are pretty obvious, but we don't talk that much about North America. And so I was really curious in my initial research to see, you know, what is going on with pre-Columbia America? Is there a different picture? Is there a different perspective than the one we get in school where we're taught really that nothing really happened here until Columbus and the European settlers came? So that was really my impetus in this work. And one thing led to another. I started writing for Wayne May in Ancient American Magazine, which is a great magazine. I always shout out to it. And just through Wayne May and some other people, John Lefgren and some others, I got to interact with some really amazing researchers who are kind of providing a new perspective on the history of ancient America.
Well, that's fantastic. That's a really good intro. But one thing in following you and following your work, and I love your fascination with ancient civilizations because I share that same fascination. The technologies they had and the societies, you know, that they had, and how I feel like so much has been misconstrued, possibly hidden away. That's kind of where my fascination comes with. But one thing that I love about your work and that I'm extremely interested in is your expertise in giants specifically that lived in North America. So I told you a little bit before we got started, this is really our first episode that we're doing about giants specifically. So just give us a little bit of information, if you would, about your belief and the evidence behind the reasons that you believe that there were giants and possibly still are, maybe, in North America.
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. So when I started my research, it led me to a group of people known as the Mound Builders. More specifically, they're called in academic literature, the Hopewell and the Edina. That wasn't their original names. Those were the names of the people who lived on those properties, lived where those two civilizations were many centuries later. but we just know them as the mound builders. And the really interesting thing about the mound builders is that in the 1900s, as people were basically going westward and exploring, at least Europeans were exploring the country. Native Americans had always been here, but as Europeans were exploring it, they started to uncover these mounds built by the mound building people. And I'll call them Native American mounds because Native Americans are basically synonymous with them. But they started to uncover these mounds, and inside the mounds were skeletons of gigantic persons ranging from 7 to 9 feet, some taller. And so they start to find these all over the United States, and really kind of shedding light on who these people were. And everyone, and basically it was a foregone conclusion for many academics in the 19th century that these were in fact giants. In fact, Abraham Lincoln and Thomas Jefferson mentioned the mound builders as giants. But starting in kind of the late 1800s, there is a pushback against this view, even though most people understood the mound builders to be giants. There starts to be a pushback to really kind of, as you said, I like the word that you used, hide this information, particularly with the Smithsonian and government agencies, to kind of hide the idea that there was any type of advanced civilization, including these giants, in North America. And there's a whole political and kind of a religious agenda behind that. So slowly there's kind of a misinformation agenda that all of these giants are hoaxes, that all of these findings are fake. And so it basically gets hushed up, even though people continue to find giant skeletons up into the 1930s and 1940s. If you go online, I always give a shout out to this website as well, Giants of North America. It gives thousands of newspaper clippings of people finding giants throughout the 1800s. And there's also pictures. So this is something that is extremely well documented. We have very good documentation for it. And you know, even if maybe 5% of these newspaper articles are true, giving valid information, that's a heck of a lot of giants. And personally, I think that there's a lot more than just 5 or 10% that are true. I think that many of them are true. Now, do you have hoaxes sometimes? Yes, with every phenomenon, you have people who try to make money off of it, who try to get famous off of it. But that's not the case with the majority of these finds. The majority of these people are farmers, blue collar people, your average American who is, you know, farming on his property, finds a mound, and there's some giant skeletal remains in it. So very well documented.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's something that I was going to bring up. I'm glad that you brought that up. Was, you know, you have figures like Abraham Lincoln, Thomas Jefferson. I mean, presidents, leaders of this country.
Yeah.
That, you know, that was their fact. I can't even call it a belief, because, you know, they firmly were, their foundation were these mound builders, and the skeletal remains found in these mounds were that of giants. Yeah, correct. Mm-hmm. And if I'm not mistaken, I had read maybe even Thomas Jefferson talking about it, especially or even on his property of Monticello around Charlottesville.
Thomas Jefferson, it's interesting, he did the first government-funded excavation of these mounds. So you kind of see the shift where you have basically this freaking founding father who is initiating this academic archaeological research of a mound. And then you contrast that with 100 years later, the late 1800s, where you have the government trying to hush this whole thing up and suppress this. So much different than how things started out.
What do you think the reasoning for that was in that 100 year time? Why do you think that it went from a president of the United States saying, well, these are the ruins or the remains of giants in North America, to well, these are all hoaxes. There's no such thing as never been anything as giants.
Well, I think the one major difference that you have is the whole manifest destiny doctrine that becomes very, very popular in the late 1800s. So that understanding of the land as it's being explored by the Europeans as a European-only land. So you have this tension between the Europeans and the Native Americans who are already on that land. And in order to kind of demonize and dehumanize the Native Americans, you have to say that they didn't have any civilization, that there was no culture to them, that they were basically nothing. So these mound builders, whom the Native Americans are descended from, represent a direct threat to that. You also have, and this kind of goes to my own kind of religious affiliation, but in the late 1800s, you also have the Mormon Wars, which, you know, not a lot of people know about, but a very big deal where the Mormons are basically trying to establish their own kind of realm and basically butting heads directly with the United States government, which views them basically as this polygamous outlaw radical religious group. Now, this is important because the Mormons in their sacred scripture, or our sacred scripture, I should say, I'm not part of the Utah LDS Church, but I am part of a Latter-day Saint tradition. And we all believe in the Book of Mormon. In the Book of Mormon, there is basically the gist of it is that there was cultural diffusionism from the old world, specifically from the Middle East, to America. And the culture of the giants, again, kind of seems to support that view. We can talk more about this, but not only are giant skeletal remains found, but with these giants are inscriptions that seem to very much come from the old world, and the giant culture itself seems to come from the old world. So the government literally fighting the Mormons, there's basically a big war. You know, we talk about the Civil War, we talk about my favorite one, the Mexican War of Independence, or the Texas War of Independence with the Alamo and stuff. But we don't talk about the Mormon War. That was just as big of a war as some of these other ones. And literally Mormons are fighting the U.S. government, basically saying, you know, we deserve religious freedom. And the U.S. government's really trying to quell the growth of Mormonism. So one of their concerns is that, you know, if there's evidence for cultural diffusionism, like the Book of Mormon claims, then this will support, you know, the Mormons over and against the government. So I think both of those factors are going on. Manifest destiny, so a political factor and also a religious factor, basically the government's fear of these Mormons.
That's interesting. That's extremely interesting. Where do you think these giants came from? Do you think that they were just here? I know that we all had to come from somewhere. I guess what I'm trying to say is, you know, the kind of mainstream is, you know, North America was just this empty place, and millions of years ago, there was a land bridge, and people from the Far East came over on the land bridge. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's the mainstream. How do you think that, you know, the giants and the native peoples of this country, how did they come to be here?
Well, here I'm going to say that I think you can have two views simultaneously. I do think it's possible to uphold the migrationist model in Clovis, as well as the diffusion model. So for myself, and one of the things I argue in my book is that these giants are basically from the Israel-Palestine region. Possibly there's an Egyptian connection with that as well, which I can talk about a little bit more. But they're basically from the Middle East, and that there are multiple migrations of giants into the New World over the course of many centuries. Usually during times of political upheaval in the Middle East. So, for example, when the Assyrians destroy the northern kingdom of Israel, there's a migration of giants. When the Babylonians destroy the southern kingdom, there's a migration of giants. When the Romans destroy the temple in 70 CE, there's a migration of giants. And they migrate this way because they know about the path to get to North America from their giant ancestors. But they come to North America and they interbreed and intermix and interact with the cultures that are already here, the indigenous Native American cultures. And that's why Native American culture retains a lot of the Semitic features that we have from the giant civilizations. So, for example, the Black Irish Cherokee make the claim, the legitimate claim, I think, that they are descended. They're one of the lost tribes of Israel. And I think that comes directly from this giant connection. Also, when Europeans were first coming to this country, to North America in the 17th century or so, they encountered these huge, super tall Native Americans. And they wrote about them in their diaries. They made sketches of them. And in the late 1800s, going back to this kind of suppression agenda, a lot of these pictures were modified to make the Native Americans look just as tall as the Europeans. Again, a political agenda. If you're trying to conquer, you can't have your enemies taller than yourself. So literally, they took erasers and stuff and erased this stuff, erased the picture a little bit, and then drew a smaller person into it. But they're encountering these giant Native Americans. I think that comes directly from this interbreeding, this intermixing between these giants, not indigenous to North America, and the Native American population.
You know, that makes a lot of sense, because a few episodes ago, we did like a three-part Bigfoot episode. You know, we broke it up in like three different parts on our show. And one of those stories is called, or accounts, is the Bigfoot Wars of 1855. And in that account, there's this commander, LaFleur, and he has this native army around him. And it claims that these, what was the name of this tribe, Ryan? Do you remember?
Black Irish Cherokee.
I think that's what they were, but the Tubi family name, something like that. Anyway, they claim that these peoples were upwards of 7-8 feet tall, you know, the natives that were part of this army. And they encountered Sasquatches that were terrorizing the village and their society at the time. And so, I mean, that, you know, even that story seems, well, I mean, you have Bigfoot, you have giant natives all tied up into one. But it was, at the time, you know, we have death certificates of people involved that did die during that time. We have, you know, firsthand accounts from these people that were passed down until now. So, you know, I'm a firm believer in, with all legend, with all, with every myth, there's at least a little bit of fact in there.
At least. I think most myths have, you know, at their core, you know, fact to them. I mean, I always give this example because I'm a Latin teacher, but for many years, we thought that up until the late 1800s, we thought that the Trojan War was just a complete myth. And Schliemann comes and uncovers the entire city of Troy and even King Priam's treasure. The name Priam is right on the treasure. So,
yeah.
A lot of myths have a historical foundation at the core. It's interesting you mentioned Bigfoot. I love Bigfoot. Absolutely love Bigfoot. So going back to the giant civilization and basically what happens to these giants, why aren't they here anymore? A lot of researchers have speculated that, you know, they died out around the 4th or 5th century CE, so around 400 to 500 CE, maybe even 6th century CE. But there was some type of violent conflagration, and they basically killed each other off. But they didn't all die, and it's been my suspicion, and I need to do more research on this, but I have mentioned it elsewhere, that the traditions of Bigfoot are perhaps the remnants of these giants. So you have the literal remnants of these giants fighting, you know, with the Bigfoot Wars of 1855, fighting with kind of the Native Americans who have interbred with these earlier giants, and that explains, you know, their tallness as well. So very interesting.
Gosh, I love that. I love that. Thinking that they're fighting these OG giants, and they're a couple generations down, that they've are a hybrid of a human giant.
Yeah. And a lot of the features of Bigfoot, you know, we think of Bigfoot, we think of Sasquatch as just this monstrous being. But, you know, a lot of the accounts, he's actually pretty intelligent, and he seems to be hiding.
Yeah.
And that seems, you know, in my view, what the giants did, you know, once they had this violent war, you know, and honestly, I think that, you know, the Native American population, because these giants were cruel, were trying to kill, you know, were trying to, you know, kill them, make them extinct. And so they hid. And that's exactly what Sasquatch does. Doesn't come out in plain sight, still hiding, you know, after all of these centuries.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. So what do you believe that these giants looked like? You know, what were their features?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the skeletons that we have, there's seems to be multiple types of giants. Some of them look just like you and me, but just were tall. Others of them had elongated skulls, kind of, I'm always say the Indiana Jones Kingdom of the Crystal Skull type of giant. And then others seem to have had pronounced teeth or pronounced fingers, kind of like claws. So not all giants are the same. I think there's multiple reasons for that. I think you have multiple types of giants who are migrating. Excuse me, some of them not from the Middle East. So I think sometimes you have giants from Europe and stuff who also know the way here to North America, and they're migrating, and that explains the difference. With many of the mound builders, there seems to have been an elongated skull, elongated cranium, showing kind of heightened brain activity. And this kind of explains some of the parallels that you get in the design of the mounds versus some of the mounds that you get in the old world in Europe. So like Stonehenge, very similar. And I think that both the mounds here and the mounds in the old world, are built using kind of this psychic technology, this psychic power that these mound builders had with their super big heads.
So you said something with which I love the whole of psychic abilities and telekinetic abilities that these things, these giants may have had, because that would explain, you know, a lot of the monoliths that, you know, people don't know that we have here in North America. But, you know, there's giant monoliths that are still around today with these tremendous, I mean, enormous rocks.
Yeah.
You said something there with the elongated skulls. And I know we're going to get more into this. And we may just dive into it right now because it triggered something with me. You hear and read a lot about, like the pharaoh, these had these elongated skulls or were extremely tall beings.
Mm-hmm.
You see the ancient Sumerian kings list.
Yes.
That, you know, a lot of these people, these kings were described as being, you know, extremely tall. Yes. I think you had, was it Og? One of them, it's claimed even in scripture that his bed was close to 13 and a half feet long.
Mm-hmm.
So yep. this whole elongated skull thing and the ties to the Mesopotamian area, you know, okay, to Egypt, to Israel. Yes, Ryan, we got you now, buddy.
Yep.
Did you had a question, right?
Yes.
Go ahead.
My question was, Adam, with
shapes of these mounds, the elongated skulls, talking about the land bridge and how it's similar to Stonehenge in Europe and everything. And if I'm not mistaken, if you're coming from the Middle East, that's the track you would take.
Yes.
Come to North America.
Yep.
Do you tie these guys back to Egypt, like the pharaohs that always had the hats and everybody assumed they had the elongated skulls?
Yeah.
And the shapes of the pyramids.
And I'm glad you guys mentioned that, because so Zachariah Sitchin talks about the Sumerian king list in Egypt, Akhenaten. We know for a fact that he had an elongated skull. He's taller in the hieroglyphics and in the picture, the pictographs that we have in the pyramids. The pharaohs are much taller than the regular people. If you watch the movie Gods of Egypt, one of my favorite movies, for example, I know it got a lot of flack and stuff because of the casting, but it's one of my favorite movies. So you'll notice that the gods are much taller than the human beings. And that's something that is depicted in the reliefs of the pharaohs themselves. So the pharaohs are always depicted as taller than the regular human beings. And I think that, you know, these guys are directly connected to the giants of North America. Now we think of the Egyptians as kind of the arch enemies of the Israelites. I talk about this a lot. So in the movie The Ten Commandments of Charlton Heston, basically Moses is fighting the prince of Egypt, but Israel and Egypt, for much of biblical history, in fact, most of biblical history, they are allies. They get along with each other. They intermarry. They share culture. They share identity. And so what I argue for is that you have throughout Israel's history and Egypt's history, this kind of hybrid group of Egyptians and Israelites, and they eventually make their way through Europe. And I think, Ryan, you hit it on the head when you said you would have to go through Western Europe into Britain to get to the Atlantic. And we can trace that, we can kind of trace that movement in the traditions of various European cultures. So the Danish, that term, if you ask Danish people where that came from, that comes from the tribe of Dan in the Old Testament. And then you have a bunch of these stories in Britain, Gog and Magog, Joseph of Arimathea coming and bringing the Grail and then crossing over. Where does he go to? Well, he probably goes to North America. I won't say too much about that. I'll let Scott Walter and other people deal with that. But so they all know this route. So they're going through Europe, leaving traces of their cultural identity in Europe and the very people in Europe, and then heading over to North America. But they originate in Egypt, and that's why there's so many parallels with the mounds and the Egyptian pyramids. So Monk's Mound, for example, in Illinois, I believe, is of the same dimensions as the Pyramid of Giza.
Wow.
And another reason I want to tie this in is because we recently got into another podcast we were listening to, and they were talking about our area in particular. We are in the southwest corner of Virginia, the Kentucky-West Virginia border. Tennessee's just on the other side. We're like right there, you know. So there's a park here called the Brakes Interstate Park, and they talk about all this other stuff, which isn't involved in what we're talking about. However, there is a depiction of Ra holding a staff, and at the tip of the staff is it right where the city they're talking about in Kentucky would be, because that's how close we are to Kentucky.
Yeah.
But tying that back to Egypt, Ra, that was the sun god, right?
That's correct. Yeah,
that was the god of sun.
And we, so we put all these, you know, borders are kind of a modern invention. So, the base of operation, the central part of the central area for the mound builders would have been the Ohio region, but they spread out. And this is why we have mounds in West Virginia, in Ohio, in Kentucky, some in the western part of Maryland, Frederick, Maryland, stuff like that, because their empire spread out. So it was centralized in Ohio, but it went to these other places as well. And so this is why we find that Egyptian influence. So they found, I'm glad you mentioned this, the Ra and the staff. So they found mummies, they found statues, they found mummified cats, all in this Ohio, Midwestern region. I think all of that points back to the mound builders whose origin themselves was Egyptian and Israelite.
See,
wow.
See, I didn't tell you about that, but I tied into his research, did I, Justin?
Hey, I love your little surprises.
Hey, when you're talking about Edina and Hopewell, are you talking about the cities in Ohio?
There are cities named Edina and Hopewell, but those are named after particular individuals who lived in the 19th century. Oh. Hopewell and Edina are just the two terms that are used for these different mound building groups. So I'll explain that a little bit more. So there seem to have been two giant groups that were fighting against each other, that were competing with each other, they die out. The Hopewell die out around 400 or 500 CE.
Because I lived in Ohio for a while, but I lived in Cadiz, and the town all my friends lived in was Edina.
Yes, so that's it's named after a particular person, but that's also where mounds would originally been found. A lot of those mounds, sadly, have been destroyed, but that's where people started to find a bunch of mounds in the 1800s.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask, too, was I had read somewhere that a lot of these mounds had been, you know, completely destroyed by plow or by, the farming of the land or building infrastructure, all these things.
Infrastructure, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I know for modernization it has to be done, but there's a huge part of me that's a travesty.
That's hard. Yeah, yeah. And
that
I
we
think,
have all of these mounds. Because you, go ahead.
Yeah, I think that, going back to your comparison of Thomas Jefferson, versus what, the government of academia was in the late 19th century, I think that if we had more of kind of a Thomas Jefferson agenda where, his idea was really to research these mounds, explore them and preserve them as a part of history, it would have been much different. But this kind of the infrastructure thing was kind of, I would argue, as part of this larger agenda, people may not have been conscious of it, just to wipe away this history. So we know for a fact that a lot of these mounds were deliberately destroyed. But I think, the accidental destruction kind of tied into that as well.
Okay. So with don't the Freemasons tie in back to the Templar?
Yes. Yes. The Temple of Solomon, in fact. Yes.
So those guys being over in the Middle East, and then you have these guys coming over on the land bridge. You would imagine the Templar would have a problem with science. I would imagine. But where was I going with? With the infrastructure. So Freemasons were the actual ones who built these roads. And in specific, and Justin knows what I'm going to talk about, Route 66.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a Scottish Freemason. So from Chicago to the Mojave Desert in California, whatever town that is.
Yep, yep.
That's 2,171 miles or something like that.
Yeah, it's huge. I've driven on that before.
But if you divide that by 66, you get 32.9, which is 1/10 degree, 1 degree from being the 33rd level of a Freemason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's just fascinating. It's fascinating.
So,
it is something, I need to look in more. I have a bunch of friends who actually do stuff on, Freemasonry and, the Templar connection, the Knights Templar connection. And we know, the Freemasons and the Templars trace themselves back to Joseph of Arimathea. So, I'd be curious to research that more. Was this part of an agenda to say, these, we, us Templars and the Freemasons, who basically represent them in modern form, are really the true inheritors of this Israelite tradition from Solomon? over against these giants, and we have to, you know, kind of get rid of these giants. And so one of the way we do this is make this super huge highway that goes through their mounds. So that's something I'd be curious to look at. It's interesting because what we can determine from what's been found in the mounds and kind of the shape of the mounds themselves suggests that the giants were part of a religion that was kind of heretical when you compare it to Israelite religion as found in the Old Testament. It seems to be somewhat heretical. So you could see how, you know, with the Templars, especially with them being the paragons of orthodoxy, wanting to uphold, you know, Orthodox Christian theology, why they would have a problem with these giants. So I think it's very possible that the two of them butted heads. You know, we highly suspect that the Templars came over here as well at some point. Scott Walter talks a little bit about this. Hundreds of years ago. So it's very possible they bumped heads.
I would imagine, because even if you go all the way back to Genesis 6, eventually it says God regretted making man.
Yeah.
After the fallen one, all fallen sons of God had laid with the daughters of man, and these giants were born, and said he actually regretted it, and said their years are numbered to 120. So it's maybe, I wonder if he said more than that, because not a lot of us live to 120 anymore. That's we just didn't get the memo yet.
I think that's kind of
generations.
I think that's kind of the max. He put a max on there. I'm not going to deal with him any longer than
100. I'm not getting nowhere near that number. I know that.
Yeah. There's too much bad out there in the world today with you know, all the junk and the foods that you eat and then the air that you breathe, and yeah, it's not happening. There's too many McDonald's sitting on corners.
Yeah.
Okay, so back to this migration or the ties to the Mesopotamia, you know, the Israel Egypt area. I had read maybe even some of your work, your articles. And I know that you said that had been mummies found, you know, mummified remains and all this stuff, but hasn't there actually been Hebrew text found in some of these mounds?
Yes. So two of the big examples. So the Gray Creek Mound, I know we were talking about this earlier, in West Virginia, that has a stone in it, which I believe reads for the Judeans in Paleo Hebrew. In Newark, Ohio, at the Newark Earthworks, they uncovered these what we call Newark Holy Stones, which are basically, one of them says Kadosh Kadoshim, Holy of Holies, and the other one is kind of a paraphrase of the Ten Commandments. And then you have the Michigan relics, which are my personal favorites. I got to work with them. In fact, I hold a couple of them and do some work with them this past summer.
Man, that's awesome.
Containing biblical imagery on them. So Tower of Babel, Noah's Flood, even some Christian images, seems to be one with the life of Jesus on it. This is definitely some type of Judeo-Christian group here. And you also have in New Mexico, the Los Lunas Stone, which is written in a Paleo-Hebrew, is actually a very fascinating text. It even contains some mistakes in Paleo-Hebrew and some original forms of certain nouns and prepositions. I don't want to go too much into that, but it's what you would expect if you were looking at an ancient text written in ancient Hebrew versus someone trying to forge a text in the late 19th century with the knowledge of Hebrew that they had then.
Wow. So that's undeniable. I mean, that's undeniable. It cannot be a forgery if it's, you know, if it couldn't have been done.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. That's awesome.
I hope that, you know, it'll be interesting if someone could write a book or something on all of these different artifacts that were found. Maybe I'll do that one day. We'll see.
That sounds like a great idea. I mean, you are the author in the group here, so yeah. If anybody's going to write a book, it should be you. You know, you talked about, and this is getting back to my mind is just, I've got so many questions and it's just, I'm firing right now. Talking about the migration, you know, Ryan brought it up from that area to North America and how they would had to go through Europe. But, you know, you have accounts of giants when you look back through, you know, mythology and folklore, you know, almost every single culture that's ever lived in every civilization have stories, have accounts of giants.
Yeah.
You know, I was thinking specifically in the Europe area, you know, you can see by all this gingerness I got going on here, I have a whole lot of ties to the Scots-Irish area. Yeah. You know, you hear stories of giants in that area all throughout their history. Yeah.
Famous Irish warrior queen who was a giant. Yeah.
Wow. That's awesome. I mean, it doesn't matter what you look into. It always seems like, you know, no matter what, Greek mythology, Roman mythology, Celtic mythology, you know, even as far, like we said, as far back as the beginnings of biblical history.
Genesis 6, yeah. And all of these giants are connected. They're all seen as either warriors or having a propensity for violence. And people don't like them very much. Now, the Irish warrior queen, she uses her powers for good. She's kind of like Xena warrior princess. But most of these giants aren't described in the most flattering of terms. And I think here in North America, you know, that propensity for violence is one of the reasons why either they fought amongst themselves or the Native Americans kind of rose up in rebellion against them. And did away with them.
So do you think, okay, let's look at these mounds specifically. Yeah. Now, you believe that a lot of these, and I think that I've read some in your works, that the giants specifically had built a lot of these mounds.
Yes.
And then, you know, throughout time, possibly that the Native American peoples had learned from them
exactly
in their building of, you know, some of these smaller mounds. Am I right with that?
Yes. So Cahokia in Illinois, that's a huge mound. That's enormous. I haven't been there, but, you know, my people who have say, you know, it's absolutely amazing to see. That is a later mound. That doesn't come into existence until around, I believe, 1100 CE. So even though it might have been occupied before then, but yeah, not all mounds are the same. So some mounds actually go back to the mound builders. Other mounds are imitations of the mounds made by the mound builders. So that's a very important point.
Wow.
So people will say, you know, I went to this mound, I didn't find any giant remains. But you're not going to find giant remains because that mound is an imitation of the mounds of the mound builders.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes perfect sense. I mean, it would almost be like, I don't know how to put it. Like, say, refugees coming into a how am I trying to put this?
Hey, can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you. Some people say, like, okay, like the pyramids, for instance.
Yeah.
Some people will say that the Egyptians, when they came into there, now I don't know for sure, but this is just kind of where I'm tying it. When you hear people talk about these different theories, that when they came in, they claimed these pyramids, but they weren't actually the builders, that it was an even farther, more ancient civilization with this crazy technology. And who knows, maybe it was giants that could have built these. And then the Egyptian people come in and, you know, reside in these places and just take credit.
Yeah. Well, I think all this stuff, you know, I think you raised a really good point. All of this stuff, I think, goes back to some type of primordial knowledge from a civilization that was so old it couldn't be identified. Now, I would actually identify that civilization and say that it was Atlantis. You know, in Genesis 6, you have, you know, these giants, these Nephilim that appear to come from somewhere, but even the biblical author, even though he or she is writing, you know, in what we consider ancient times, even the civilization of the giants was so ancient, they can't identify it and name it specifically.
He said before, and they were there after.
Yes. Which so, is weird. They could have been wiped out with the Noah's flood, but yeah, they're still there. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they would have had to have survived somehow.
See, yep. I like to tie those to Odin and Zeus, and because the Ten Commandments actually says, "Thou shalt put no other gods before me." Why would he have to say that?
Yeah, that means other gods exist. So, exactly. Yeah, I tell my students, I teach an Old Testament class at a university in Philadelphia, and I always whenever I talk about the first commandment. I showed them basically a picture of the Hebrew God. This is actually a picture that was found on a cave in a place called Kuntilla Ashrud, the Hebrew God with this other deity, basically his wife Asherah, and saying, you know, it's not that other gods don't exist, but it's that the Israelites were supposed to only worship their God.
Yeah, he was the utmost and the highest.
Yeah,
that's something that me and Ryan have talked a whole lot about is about these fallen angels, you know, about how, you know, you have all these mythologies, you know, Greek mythology, you have all this pantheon of gods, you know, Roman mythology, Celtic mythology, you know, and a lot of these different mythos, you have this pantheon of all these different gods. Yeah. And, you know, that's the way we've talked. That's kind of our shared belief on that is that's probably what these gods were these fallen angels that they're in rebellion against God, against Elohim, the Elohim. And, you know, what better thing to do if you're rebelling against the utmost and the highest God is to come to earth and be proactive in that rebellion by telling the human beings and the people that are there, hey, I'm a God, worship me.
And you'll see with the giants, you know, you mentioned the Egypt, the release of the pharaohs. The giants always, in the way that they depict themselves, seem to want to basically lord it over these normal-sized human beings. So going back to North America, not only have we found these giant remains in these mounds, but also the remains of their servants who seem to be regular-sized human beings, which makes it clear to me that the regular sized human beings, whether Native Americans or whoever they were supposed to, or at least some of them looked to these giants as gods or divine figures. So that they serve.
That makes sense. Now you said a key place that is, gosh, I love it. And it's so much controversy. Atlantis. Now, what are your thoughts on the ties possibly between Atlantis, technology, these giants? Just lay it out there for us. What is your beliefs on all of that?
Yeah. I think that Atlantis is where the Nephilim originated from, but the biblical author doesn't know the name of the place. Now, in some cultures, that name is retained. So in Greek culture, Plato knows it, and he says he got it from this tradition from many thousands of years ago. But what I find interesting about when you compare the giants of North America to Atlantis, my friend Greg Little would be able to explain this in much more detail. But the Atlantis technology, from what researchers have been able to determine, wasn't like our technology today. It was more of kind of a psychic technology. They used their mind to move things. They used their mind to travel. And that's kind of like the technology that we get with the mound builders how they're building these mounds, how they're carrying this earth and all these things that decorate the mound. So the mounds looked much different back in the day than what we see them now. We just think they're the clumps of dirt, but they were highly decorated as well back in the day. So they're using their mind to move all this stuff. And I think that they get that comes directly from their heritage in Atlantis. I also think that the notion of the design of the mounds with the pyramid, and I think the Egyptian pyramids are the same, that all comes from this knowledge from Atlantis. So Atlantis was said to have pyramids as well.
Man.
Frank Joseph talks about this some in his book as well.
Yeah, I love it. I love the idea of that kind of technology, because he actually talks about this a little bit in the last episode we did with the guest that we had there. Is, you know, it talks about the flood, and it talks about how, you know, even Jesus himself spoke the words that when end times come, it'll be as in the times of Noah.
Yeah.
And people can, you know, you can interpret that however you want. But there's also, you know, dozens of times, you know, throughout Ecclesiastes, Songs of Solomon, that the author says there's nothing new under the sun. Mm-hmm. So if you take that literally, you know, did these ancient civilizations, say Atlantis, say, you know, whatever civilization, whatever title you want to put on there, you know, did they have technologies that were far superior to anything that we see today?
I think so. You know, we only, you know, we talk about history today. What we talk about with history only goes back at the max like 20,000 years. And we don't really know what happened before them. But I very much agree with my friend Cliff Dunning here that human history is cyclical. So it goes around and around. So a society advances to the height of technology, then through its pride, then through its own arrogance kind of falls. And then humanity goes through a dark time and starts up again. And I think that this has happened, you know, for thousands of years. And you can see this in the religious text throughout the world. So, you know, the Hindu tradition, they have, basically ships and technology that is said to have existed, you know, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of years ago, very similar to what you read in a science fiction novel. One of the shows that I'm a fan of, I like the 1970s version more, but I think the 2003 version did a really good job, Battlestar Galactica, where you have basically in its season 4 and season 5 arc, this notion of, you know, ancient, really high-tech societies, the Cylon society, then it gets destroyed in a nuclear disaster and people start again. And they have some imprint of this past society that's passed down onto them, but not really. So they have to start again. And then that society gets destroyed and it continues over and over and over again. And I think that's what's going on. I don't think that we are at all the pinnacle of civilization, even though we have, you know, our iPhones and tablets and cool stuff like that. I think that, you know, human beings, you know, we've been here for an extremely long time, and that some of our civilizations were extremely high advanced, even more high advanced than we have now.
You know, our friend Lance just last week was saying that he believes pre-flood that society had gotten advanced, if not further than what we are now.
Yeah.
Absolutely. That's when I made the joke that that's why Noah started drinking on the ark, because his phone died and he couldn't play Candy Crush anymore. Bored.
But. That's right. No, I absolutely agree. I agree 110% with that view. Yeah. Yeah.
That was even one of his theories, was that maybe these giants, these Nephilim, you know, whatever title you want to put on a being that we know existed before and after the flood, because scripture tells us that it did. He said, you know, maybe they even had the technology at the time that they were able to go off world throughout the time frame that the flood was there.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, I've talked about this in other places as well, but you know, people talk about, you know, that pyramid on Mars, and even, you know, some pyramids on the moon. What's up with those? And I think, you know, NASA can try to scrub the images as much as they can. That pyramid's not going away. So what's up with that? And
yeah.
It's up there. So
you remember the Ark from the Marvel movies? Thor's people get on it during Ragnarok. You know, maybe Noah built an Ark. You know,
Well, you know, it's funny because the term for ark, actually the phrase that's used in the Bible is really interesting and really kind of funky. It doesn't say that the ark, we think of the ark as a big boat. It actually does not say that in the Hebrew text. It says al ha'aretz, so the ark floated above the earth. Same as in Latin, supratera, so above the earth. So I've always thought of the ark is kind of like this big kind of Amazon warehouse spaceship type of thing.
like a giant blimp
that's flying above everything. I never thought that it floated on water, and the biblical text technically doesn't support that either.
Wow.
And you know what? That would tie in with it landing. What is that mountain?
Ararat.
Ararat.
Yes, Ararat. That would be the highest peak at that area.
Yeah.
As the water receded, that's where they would land. Yep. Now, this is just coming to me. I do no research, Adam, except for listening to you and reading your articles. I'm a shoot from the hip type of guy. When it comes to me, that's when I get my best ideas, I feel.
Well, you know, that's what this show is about, is to explore all these possibilities that are out there. I mean, you know, a lot of, you know, just like you said, what did the Hebrew say? And then what did the Latin say? And then what did the Greek say? And then what did the English say? You know, it's being translated so many, and a lot of times in these languages, you know, like Hebrew, there is no direct translation into the English language.
No, you're going through translation, through translation, through translation. Yeah,
absolutely. So, you know, a man of your caliber who is, you know, an expert in a lot of these ancient languages, you know, like Latin, you know, a lot of these dead languages, as you might say, that are very much alive when you start looking into topics like this, because that's when you're literal. That's the literal representation of what the authors at the time, that's what they penned. Mm-hmm. You know, and they didn't pen it for, I don't believe they penned it for, you know, they penned it for the people of the time to understand.
Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of these things that we say, well, it says this, but I mean, you've got to take it for what it says.
Yeah. You can't bring your own views, try, and we do that a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, we do. Okay. All right. Back to Giants. That was a fun little tangent, but back to Giants. And I just have one question because it ties into a little bit of the research that me and Ryan are doing right now for a different kind of project. But these mounds specifically, what was the spiritual basis behind the building of these mounds? I mean, I know that they were like, there was ritualistic burials and stuff like that going on here, but just spiritualism in general around these mounds, what would that have looked like?
That's a great question. Mainstream academia, it kind of shies away from this question and just says, well, these were ceremonial mounds, but doesn't really go into the meat of it. I think the mounds serve the same purpose as the temple in Jerusalem, as kind of a connecting point between the human and the divine realms. And the dimensions of the mounds, there's a book, I'm trying to find it because I had it, but it was written in the 1950s, and it gave an actual diagram of the Hopewell Mound. And the diagram was very similar to the diagram of the tabernacle in the Old Testament. So you had a separate sleeping room. So in a story of 1 Samuel, for example, Eli sleeps in this separate room. And then in the next room, you had the sacred or the divine fire. The Hopewell Temple is a Hopewell temples that were on top of these mounds were designed exactly like that. So I think that there's a divine human connection there. Now, related to this, the mound that I got to see in Kentucky, in Lexington, Kentucky, it was an Adena mound. And it was two mounds. There was a smaller mound, and then there was a slightly larger mound next to it. And again, I think that served a divine human a purpose of connecting the divine and human worlds, the supernatural and the natural world. So Greg Little talks a little bit about this in his book, but the belief that the soul, so the mound represented the journey of the soul. So the large mound to the small mound could represent the death of the body and the soul moving to a higher realm, or to represent kind of a reincarnation of the soul moving back into a smaller body. So there's a bunch of, a bunch of religious purposes here, but it can all be summarized as kind of a supernatural, natural connection, divine, human connection, and the focal point were these mounds.
Now, are they only tied to burials, or, and I don't know their exact placements of these mounds, but could they be like landmarks as well as they were, if they're done a different way?
I think they're landmarks as well. So, you know, if you drive down, I don't know what the highway is from West Virginia into Ohio, into Kentucky. I've driven it several times. 60-something.
Well, it goes, which part of? Now, 77 runs all the way up, and so does, in 79, I think, goes into Pennsylvania. Right?
I'll tell you, where the Mothman is, where is that in West Virginia?
79, and you can also take the Somerville Road. I think that's like 51 or something, but 79 goes all the way up through Fairmont and all that.
So if you take 79, if you take it into Ohio, all these mounds seem to be on a particular ley line. So they're all like connected to each other. You can hop from Fort Ancient to Newark to the Edina Mound in Kentucky, all on the same exact line. So I think that they were strategically positioned. So I think it's a great question. They're not just burial places. I think there's also some type of alignment with them. And we know that there's some type of astrological alignment with them, but I think more is going on there. That's something I need to need to do some more research into.
And also, Justin, this just occurred to me, but so in this Rex Interstate Park we were talking about earlier, this is where all these things kind of go on. And then when we're talking about infrastructure, how long did it take them to build that road, Justin?
The road, the new road from like going, you're starting to cut out again, by the way, but it was a really long, it was years and years and years. They talked about having the Coalfield Express is what they called it, being a straight shot, you know, from Grundy to Pikeville, pretty much.
You're talking 12, yeah. 14 years, right?
Yeah, it's been a pretty good while, yeah.
I wonder what they were demolishing on their way, covering up. Yeah. Oh, man, now I'm mad. I'm happy we got that road. You just gotta know where we live, Adam. It takes forever to get to a Walmart, man. These roads make a difference.
But you're right. What possibly could have been destroyed in the process of, you know, making it more convenient for me to get to Walmart? I mean, you know, again,
we're always in for the easy. Give us the convenient, easy, updated, and I love technology, so I'm you know. I'm going after that Galaxy S22. So.
Yeah, but I think that was a point that was made earlier, that Adam made earlier too, that really struck home with me. You know, saying that their technologies, you know, ancient civilizations' technologies may have been more advanced, and but maybe it was a different kind of, because a lot of the technology that we have today. And I know that it's really, really convenient. I mean, I wouldn't be able to get anywhere anymore without, you know, punching it in on Google Maps.
Yeah.
But a lot of it is a distraction too. You know, how many hours a day do we spend with our face in some kind of screen instead of interacting with the world around us, interacting with nature, interacting with, you know, with relationships and social interaction, and, you know, to be able to see these synchronistic things happening, you know, in our lives that are kind of pushing us toward a certain spot, or, you know, keeping us held back from a certain spot. You know, we spend so much time distracted by this awesome technology that we have today, but maybe during that time, it was more of a, how to put it? Just a different version of technology that was based more biologically and of the mind and of the brain, possibly.
It was part of your essence rather than taking away from it.
Yes, that was way better. That was way better than what I was trying to say.
Yeah, I definitely think it was. I think we were more, I think humans in general were more attuned to, you know, their environment in ancient times than we are now. Like you said, you know, I spend most of my day playing Indiana Jones pinball. So, you know, when I'm not working, so, or with the kids. So, you know, we have, and my kids, my son, he has a condition where he needs his phone on him. So, you know, he has his phone just for medical purposes. But, you know, on the weekends, we let them have electronics, and they're tuned to their electronics all the time, unless we go out somewhere. Sometimes I have to kick them out the house, say, go in the backyard. We have this huge backyard. They're paying the mortgage. Go in the backyard and play.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. I agree 100%. Okay, so this is kind of the last question that I have. And again, Adam, thank you so much for coming on here. I mean, this has been an amazing conversation. And the last question that I really have, we keep talking about these ancient civilizations, and we keep talking about, you know, the Mesopotamian area and Greece and Rome. And, you know, we know that there were huge civilizations in China and in the Far East in these areas. Do you believe that the civilization in North America around possibly, or maybe even earlier than these other civilizations, do you think that they were at the capacity of these other areas and regions of these great civilizations of the world?
Yes, absolutely. And we know that, you know, like I said, you look at the mounds today, they just seem like clumps of dirt, but really they were the center of these various cities. So there would have been, you know, houses and villages all around them that were huge. But like I said, in modern times, it looks like there was nothing there. But I think that, you know, and this is where I'm going to shout out to technology today. I know we've been bashing modern technology, but, you know, with such things as LIDAR, ground penetrating radar and stuff like that, we're able to find, you know, see what things would have looked like, you know, thousands of years ago. And like I said, the Hopewell and Adena, their empire stretched, you know, from Ohio all the way perhaps down to New Mexico and even all the way possibly to the Atlantic. So this was a huge empire that we were talking about. Very sophisticated. We know that their technology, for example, do I have the arrowhead? No, I do not have that arrowhead. But we know that their technology, specifically with warfare, was very highly advanced. They were using very refined copper arrowheads for battle. So yes, this civilization was just on par with Greece and Rome. And it is one of the things that I hope that, you know, my work does, and the work of others as well, is kind of bring this to light. You know, we always talk about Greece and Rome. I love Greece and Rome. I've devoted, you know, my life as a Latin teacher. So, you know, they're very important to me. But we also need to know about what's happening here in North America and the history, to paraphrase Scott Walter, the history of so much about North America, it is wrong and just needs to be fixed.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's great. Well, Adam, man, thanks again so much for coming on here. We appreciate your expertise. We love getting people on here that are way smarter and know way more about a subject than we do. But before we go, before we end this thing, you got anything you want to plug? Anything for the people to check out?
Yeah, Justin. So I have a Instagram page, Adam the Giant Guy. I'm always posting stuff about giants in North America and elsewhere. I also have a site, just a general ancient history site on Facebook, Lingua Classica. That is my tutoring page. I have a Latin tutoring business, but I also just put a bunch of ancient history stuff, Greek and Roman, but other stuff as well on occasion. I'll put up there as well. I've contributed to Ancient American Magazine. Haven't written an article recently, but if you look at some back issues, especially from last year, you'll see a couple of my articles in there. And of course, my book, From Egypt to Ohio, that can be found on Amazon.
Guys, check that book out. Definitely. I have it on order right now. I actually meant to order it like a week ago. Other things came up and I just remembered, you know, like yesterday, hey, we're interviewing Adam tomorrow. I've got to check out this book. I did pull up some articles online. I did do my homework in that area, but I'm very intrigued and I'm really excited to get this book in and to read it. And Adam, I just want to thank you for doing what you do. I know that it's not always the popular thing to, you know, have these ideas and these thoughts and these beliefs and to stand for those things, you know, not to just be persuaded otherwise, or just because it's not, you know, standards of academia. Yeah. And you know that lifestyle. I mean, goodness gracious, I done your intro. You've been to 17 different Ivy League schools. I mean, you know what academia is all about, and that
right, yeah,
that model. So for you standing for what you believe in, and for trying to get that truth out there, I appreciate that, I would love to see more guys like you stand on solid ground and on truth. And push that forward.
Thanks, Justin. I appreciate that.
So, you know, he has a BS and a master's, and you and I have a master's in BS. That's what we do.
That's the difference. That's why we got to have people like him on.
Yeah, but no, I get excited about that. All my questions have been locked in since I listened to you on Bo's podcast. And I was like, oh man. We get to interview this guy. I'm going to ask about this, if this ties in, because it was what I was thinking the whole time. You know, I was just going back to Egypt and then following that land bridge path. I was like, yeah. Stonehenge. You said it, Stonehenge.
Yeah.
Another, is it Scotland or Ireland that has like a miniature Stonehenge, but it's not actually like,
Yep.
They're still excavating there, right?
Yep, and in Nova Scotia in Canada, there's some. Yep.
See, that's where all my bloodline comes from.
Oh, okay.
Scotia, the Scandinavia area.
I was up in Nova Scotia. Oh my gosh, more than that. Oh my gosh, 18 years ago. Beautiful, absolutely beautiful. So, had to cross into Prince Edward Island on this huge bridge that I didn't think was ever going to end.
I'm not a bridge guy, Adam.
This bridge was hard. And I don't usually get scared of bridges. Like, bridges are the last thing. But this thing, like, went into, like, eternity or something like that.
We've gone through a portal.
Yeah. I thought I was going to come out of, like, the Stargate or something like that. I was really scared.
Yeah, I would say. Well, Ryan, you got anything else before we end this thing?
Just that I really appreciate it, Adam. This has been a lot of fun. I always like getting an extra wrinkle on the brain, you know, and you did that for me tonight. That's
this is a great conversation.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Well, Adam, again, thank you so much. We'll have to do this again. We'll keep in touch. And if you have new information on the horizon, you always have an open door here to come on and share that. And I know that we talked earlier pre-recording, you're working on a couple different things now. And whenever those things do come to fruition, let us know. We'll come on here and have another conversation and we'll let the people know where to find that stuff too.
Sounds great. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you, sir.
Take care.
Guys, until next time, we'll see y'all later. We'll be right back.
This episode sponsored by Maximus Tribe. You train, you track, you eat right. But if you're over 40, you've felt it. The results don't match the effort anymore. That's not willpower, it's biology. Hormones drop, metabolism slows, your body stops responding the way it used to. Maximus is the online clinic that reverses your decline with prescription performance medicines, GLP-1s, testosterone, and peptides that reduce belly fat, restore energy, and boost recovery. Over 50,000 high performers have already broken through their plateaus. If you're ready to turn your hard work into measurable results, go to MaximusTribe.com. That's MaximusTribe.com.
IPVanish protects every device you own, your phone, your laptop, your smart TV. If it connects to the internet, it should be protected. IPVanish encrypts your connection and masks your IP address, helping keep your browsing private at home and on public Wi-Fi. And with no device limits, one account covers everything. Stream with added privacy. Browse securely. Connect with confidence. Right now, save 83% off the 2-year plan. Get started today at ipvanish.com/audio and take control of your privacy with IPVanish.